and welcome to this episode of the Newcastle Oral History Unit podcast. Throughout this series, we will broadcast regular episodes that feature some of the fantastic interviews that we have conducted over the last couple of years. Episodes will range from project-specific discussions to conversations with leading international oral historians about their own practice and future directions within the field. Please feel free to contact us at any time via email, where we're at oralhistory@newcastle.ac.uk, or follow us on Twitter, where we're at @NCL_oralhistory. I'm Andy Clark, and this episode features a roundtable conversation with Professor Paula Hamill. Paula is an internationally recognised oral historian and public historian who has written extensively on memory and in recent years about the role of the senses in oral history. Paula delivered her 2019 public lecture and continues to be a key critical friend of the unit. The voices you hear throughout are myself, Paula, Graham Smith, Alison Atkinson-Phillips and Sue Bradley. Our roundtable conversation begins with Paula explaining how she came to recognise the role of the senses in oral history interviews. I hope you enjoy.
I got interested in the history of sound. How it started, and then I moved to thinking about the other senses. But it's not. It's also very hard. Like, it is really hard, theoretically, in the sense of thinking, how do you make smell work?
I'm so glad you said that, because I've read that article three times under the same question.
If you want to move beyond nostalgia, you know, like the smell of the workman, the workman's clothes when he comes home. Great, you know, it's beautiful stuff. It's literary, it's gorgeous, but so what?
Yeah.
You know, if you want to move beyond that, which I think is vital, that's where it gets hard. So, yeah, but on the other hand, it can be used in a particular way. Like, people have used the sense, say, of difference in taste and smell and stuff in terms of cultural difference. That you know, and you can then come to conclusions about cultural difference through the senses, which at least make, you know, is not as difficult as trying to analyse what sound and smell mean beyond a question of re-immersion or reimagining the past, which I think is a beautiful thing to do, but it doesn't take us forward analytically.
No.
That's kind of been the central conundrum of the work, of my work, really. The relationship, the tension between the individual and the social.
Yeah. And then if you throw the biological in.
So.
Yeah.
I don't have any answers.
No.
I can talk to you about collective memory, et cetera, but I don't think that really, I mean, there are pros and cons, and you can be comfortable with the notion of the way in which individuals take on collective kinds of strategy, memories as strategic, and there's no doubt that the way we use language and all of those things are collective, even if we think they're individual. But I still don't know the answers in terms, you know, I don't have a theory of the relationship between the social and.
Okay, before asking you where we take this forward from, and try to think about that, there's a sort of, that sort of, if everyone has the same capacity to smell, taste, feel, see things the same way, which we don't.
Yeah, we don't. No.
So there's a biological element. But if we'd set that biological element aside, I think the sort of Bourdieu argument's not a bad one, that taste is acquired. So we recognise things.
Do you mean literally
things,
taste or symbolically?
Well, it's like all those senses, and they're not all acquired over time. So one thing that tastes like poison to one community.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Doesn't to another.
Yes.
Or one, you know, or people who look, if you could, you know, if you take abstract painting to one society, they go, what the hell is that?
Yeah.
You know, so we see and feel.
It's acquired, of course, it's culturally shaped. Yeah.
But that's where I'm struggling with, is what's then the relationship with the biological, and how does that change over time?
Well, also, we smell different because of our diets. Like, people will talk about, so between Australia and Southeast Asia, where you have a much more rice-based diet, we've got a much more dairy-based diet, you often have conversations about, like, you know, you,
white people smell.
Yeah, they smell. They smell of dairy stuff.
Yeah.
And you know,
so we think they smell of spices and.
Yeah.
So it's not just about that we get used to different smells. It's that actually, like, we smell different because of the stuff that we eat. And.
But it's only when that difference becomes clear.
Yeah, because if everyone's the same, you don't notice it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the challenges of trying to even get people to talk about different senses in the first place is that we just don't notice them.
Yeah, because it's so embedded.
That's right. Well, there's an interesting assumption you're questioning there, which is, why are we using the senses to mark out difference
rather than
investigate it in different ways? Well, I don't. I mean, the latest thing I've worked on, which is part of my domestic service project, I actually looked at the way in which the senses operate in terms of power. But also, even the kind of desire, like you often get domestic servants combing people's hair there. And, you know, these incredible intimacies that are very sensual. So, I mean, you know, the person who's worked on this is Laura, you know, the anthropologist who did the work on Java, and forget her name, but she's brilliant. But so I think that you can use the senses in very different ways. I'll have to send you the article, because you won't buy the book because it's too expensive.
Wait, if I review it.
Which book is this?
There's a book that I... this is a book called Memory, Sound and the Senses that I co-edited, and I've got a chapter in it on my domestic servants. And I actually open with bells, like the sound of bells and what bells do and how they mean for calling servants and how they mean that they're constantly on edge, constantly needing to be aware, to hear, you know, those kinds of things. I have not interviewed domestic servants. I did a lot of interviews of domestic servants in the 80s. I have not interviewed them about the senses. I discovered it by recognising it in interviews.
Yeah.
And this is what you were saying.
Yeah, it's there.
You go and you think, why didn't I see this before?
We just were not attuned to that.
Yeah,
you know, and I think that's really, really interesting.
Yeah,
I think that kind of goes back to just all the different facets of an interview that's there. So I get an email from Chloe Duckworth, an archaeologist who looks at making things,
glass mainly,
and she emailed me saying, "I'm doing a symposium on making. Would you be interested?" And I was like,
"Fascinating!
Why are you asking me this?" And then I remembered all the engineers I interviewed for Sigmund Pumps, and every one of them was talking about what they used to do.
Yeah,
94-year-olds.
Yep.
Automatically, I was like, of course that's there.
It's
the layering of... Like, you don't realise it until...
Absolutely.
You're better, so you notice it yourself, but for me it's usually someone else has to say this.
Absolutely.
But actually, I've got to say, the kicker in that one is, again, if you... And I'm sure Sue's done the same about vets. You know, we've got the same in general practice. And the engineers are of a certain age. So this idea of hands-on was a big thing for my dad's generation, and less so for engineers that followed my dad. So that if you look at those interviews, and I've done this, I've looked at interviews of generations of general practitioners, the idea of laying on the hands, of touching a patient, was very much the 1950s and 1960s.
Yeah.
By the time you get to the 70s, you're thinking you're going to get sued.
Yeah.
Now, that's the response you get from different GPs. You say, you know, what do you think about this embodied
She's kidding, but I've got a respondent, Andy, for me. You go.
Well, there's masses in the. I've been doing recordings with veterinary surgeons, and I'm currently working on a project to do with animal health.
Yes.
With livestock health.
Ah.
So it is completely imbued with sensory experience.
Yes.
It's the senses is how vets engage with their world. And their sensory skills are very highly developed in training. Say, for instance, in the 50s, I remember a vet telling me in their finals, they would have a bone behind their backs that they would have to use their hands to identify which bone that was.
Oh, that's amazing.
Isn't
what
it?
A story.
So there's all kinds of ways in which the senses come into veterinary practice and are embodied in those skills and their knowledge. And I think my take on hands would be different from yours, because it isn't, I don't see it as a power thing in veterinary practice at all. It's an essential way of interpreting experience.
I think you have to historicise that. I think, and this is what I really like to try and do with the stuff that I've thought about, in terms of, it comes from a piece called Dr. Nobody, which was written by quite a well-known Foucauldian, again, from that sort of history, medicine, sociology, Foucauldian tradition. The problem is, you know, and I've called it response speech, Dr. Somebody, because actually, or somebody, making that same joke again back to them, is that it's about their relationship to the patient, but that changes over time. You're not allowed to put your hands on patients in the same way as you were before, but also it's partly the diagnostics of it.
Yes.
So the diagnostics change. If you can do an ultrasound on an animal, you no longer have to touch it in the same way.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the point. So there's a... And at first I thought, I mean, I almost did an anti-technology thing. In fact, I did do an anti-technology thing at a festival of science just to annoy them. But, you know, I now realise that actually there's more to than that.
Yep.
You know, there's something else going on.
But, all I wanted to respond to Andy.
I'm sorry. But it's the same thing. Because I engineers fascinate me, right? Because I'm really fascinated by process, which as a good oral historian you would be. But... one of the things that's also interesting is the loss of what. So my father was a motor mechanic, and he used at some stage of his life, and he used to be able to. He could hear a car drive around the block, and he could tell you what was wrong with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So their ear was so attuned to what you know, what cars, what was wrong with cars, and how they worked. That and similarly in coal mines, that there's in Spain there's a there's a sound that they hear when of the wood moving in mines when they can tell that something's going to go wrong. And so all of that is being lost. Mm. And that's what I find really sad. You know, that, and your point about ultrasound is right. And can a doctor, in the example I gave in the Proust thing, where a doctor walks in and he can smell a woman and say, I know what's wrong with you.
Auntie Yet, if you were a cow... would you rather have an ultrasound pregnancy diagnosis, or would you rather have a young vet trying to do it, figure it out manually?
Oh well, I guess for a pregnant woman.
Just a thought.
There's actually some really, it's a friend of mine, Malcolm Nicholson, who I think is really underrated in the history of science and medicine, but he's written about ultrasound, I think, in a really sensible way, where he talks about. He's always interested in A, the plasticity, and B, the unknown consequence. So that's, he's always writing about that. And the unknown consequence of ultrasound was a guy, Donaldson, who invented ultrasound, thought he was... And he got an audience with the Pope as a result of it, thought he was going to save lots of unborn babies.
Yes.
But the opposite happened.
Uh-huh.
Because the first thing the ultrasound was used for was birth defects.
Yes, yeah.
Mm. It would result in an increase in terminations, not in a decrease in terminations.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
You know, I think there's lots... I think, but what I'm saying that story again, that sort of embodied stuff, I think we have still got to get a handle on that.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, and it's part, and that's why I think the senses is a key
jigsaw
piece of that.
To your point about the embodied memory,
There's also like you know that the embodied experience of being ultrasounded.
Yes, there is.
You know,
it's a fantastic. Well, this is where my anti-science story comes from. Is this quote, which is this GP who was really didn't want all this stuff, all this technology. And he gets his first portable ultrasound and he applies it to his first woman on a couch in Paisley. And he said, I just attached it to her stomach, and I could suddenly there was this announcement: your taxi will be there in 5 minutes. And she goes, "Oh my God, is that the child?" And he goes, "No, that's the ultrasound picking up the taxi for her next door."
In this next section, Paula discusses her contribution to the edited collection Memory, Histories, Theories and Debates. Edited by Susanna Radstone and Bill Schwartz, the book brought together a range of scholars from across the social and physical sciences to discuss the dynamics of memory.
Yeah, so I was really involved in that because they wanted someone who had worked on the popular, and not many historians, oral historians or historians of memory, actually work on the on popular media and popular
memory.
Yeah. That's how I got in.
Okay.
Essentially.
So what's interesting about that, because the first time I saw a neuroscientist saying we might not know everything about everything. I mean, read a lot up to that point. So there was, what again was interesting was it tended to be I think if I'm right, it was neuroscientists who were at the end of their careers, looking back. And I thought it was just really, it was an interesting point of convergence.
Yes.
Where everyone was saying, well, for everybody who was involved in the book, I thought, because people were saying, well, maybe we don't know as much about memory as we'd all assumed.
Absolutely. I actually think it's quite difficult to be involved in memory over a long period, as I have, since the 1990s, without thinking about the biological and neurological processes. In fact, I started to read, like I read the Kandel book.
The snails.
Yeah, which is just brilliant.
It's absolutely brilliant.
I mean, I couldn't understand all the science, but I certainly got the gist of it. Right. Yeah.
And isn't it interesting, he sort of does that personal biography chapter followed by a science chapter.
Yes, it's amazing.
It's very good.
This guy was one of the people who fled America.
Fled
to America from the Nazis, from Austria. And there's an amazing photograph of, do you remember this? The medical faculty in an Austrian university saluting Hitler in the serried rows of the university. It's just chilling. But anyway, that's by the by. But because he left, the Austrians have treated him and got the Nobel Prize over there. In fact, one could argue that the whole generation of scientists, I think, that went to the United States who were Jewish have in fact been the powerhouse of American medical whatever.
And psychological, actually.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But anyway, remember when he wrote it, they were very suspicious of him coming back.
Yeah. And he wasn't very comfortable going back either.
No. Interesting, that had never occurred to me that they wouldn't, that no, people who emigrated, they would regard as rats leaving the sinking ship.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Honor, I was struck by you saying that you can't fail eventually to engage with biology when you're working with memory.
It's not that you can't fail. In fact, lots of people spend oral history. But I moved into, because I was interested in sound, oral history as sound, like orality and sound, I then moved into the senses. And again, you can't, you know, looking at that without actually looking at the biological processes or the neurological processes is kind of, you feel as if you're only concerned with the social, as if there was no medical or physiological basis to what went on. Well, of course, you know there is. Now, what you're doing is saying, what we are doing is saying perspective, perception is socially constructed, but it is also biologically based.
In this final section, Graham asks Paula about the piece that she co-wrote with Michael Frisch and Al Thompson in 1994, in which they discuss international perspectives of oral history and memory.
There was a point where you and Michael Frisch and Al Thompson wrote the piece on international memory.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting point I think that was a really interesting point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And that piece has still got resonance.
Yeah, I don't know why. But anyway, well, yes, no, it's still... I can't even remember writing it, frankly.
Do you know?
No, well, it was some time ago, 20 years.
Yeah.
But it was very big in Latin America. That the kind of concept of international, I think they were emerging then, their oral history movement was emerging then, and I think they took it up. But one of the things that interests me about the assumptions you can make, and this happened in Finland, is you can assume that the history of oral history from which you emerged, and England and the United States, is actually the way oral history has emerged everywhere. And one of the things that I asked a question of a woman who was in the Baltic countries, and she turned around and said, well, actually, memory studies developed at exactly the same time as oral history in these countries, post-1989, and I thought, shit, she's absolutely right. And it actually really made me think about the, empire assumptions you have. What do you call it?
Yeah.
About the sort of assumptions about international. People have done the same with public history, which irritates me enormously. There are not local particularities. So I was thinking then that you could have a really interesting rapprochement, in a sense, with people who have had developments of oral history in different ways.
Mm. So we've 20 years since that piece, at least 20 years since that piece, and do you think there's been, what sort of development do you think has been since then? What's the major things that you would say, well, that's how oral history has changed in terms of reflexivity or...
I got very tired of the way in which oral history was practiced for quite some time. What I called the fetishization of the interview, the obsession with the interview, and the obsession with, you know, the minutiae of this and that. And even though I support archiving and all of those sorts of things, a lot of the kind of conferences you went to or the practice you looked at was all about, you know, how to do this and how to do that. So I find that enormously arid. So for me, it was really about that shift that's come. And I don't know whether it's a result of working more broadly in memory or the effect of other disciplines or what, but the movement away from the interview to look at both, who else is in the interview, who is in this relationship, as Freud would say, but also what oral history does, what's its effect, what its impact is, you know, how it operates in a much broader landscape of the way in which memory works, right, or memory operates. That for me became something much more interesting. What has happened to the oral history movement? Well, I think, as I said earlier, that the people who are activists have kept it up, and have, so feminists, for example, have kept up very much the strength of those community archives. I mean, they're amazing. So, but they're impelled by being left out of history. But I worry about, I was saying to Ali on the way here, we were talking about how you haven't yet engaged much with ethnic groups, right? Mm. But I worry about the way in which, see, that's become a very popular area of investigation, the way in which that is conceived almost entirely on the basis of people's ethnicity, which doesn't get us very far. Mm. So what you get, and places like Australia are, history of Greeks, history of Italians, history of, yeah, blah, blah, blah. So you don't get any sense of the relationship between groups. You don't get any sense of dynamics, right? So, and it, you might argue that this is a function of multiculturalism, but, and we were saying that if you looked at something where you can incorporate a much broader range, some labour practice, for example, we were talking about shopkeepers, right? Then you could incorporate ethnicities without making it the only way in which people can identify. And I think you'd get a much richer, more rewarding way of thinking about it. I mean, there must be a heap of ways in which we... just studies of generations, you know. Then you can look at... That would be fascinating, because you can look at generational conflict between migrants. So I suppose I think there's been a lot of poor practices in relation to oral history that we're now rethinking and thinking what are the better ways in which you can conceptualise how to look at the people, the original purpose of it, you know, which was to bring people into, you know, into history. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
But we are still missing in mainstream history. See, I don't think oral history has really been mainstreamed in history. I think we are still looking at histories where, you know, the vast bulk of the people we work with aren't there. I mean...
Well, I'll tell you what's even more curious that I've come across is historians keep on wanting to do their own interviews without thinking those interviews don't exist.
Exactly.
It's really weird. You know, that oral history's still got that...
marginal status.
Well, no, it's more than that. It's that idea that you can ask the historical questions that no one else can ask.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because the people are still alive.
Yes.
But that's, you know... that's not... I don't think we've really critiqued that sufficiently to tell
stories. Completely.
Actually, you can't just ask it.
I think there's a thing as well that all historians feel they only do it properly if they did interviews themselves. And I think that...
Say that again, then.
Sorry.
It's your accent.
No. I know.
We've got to the joking stage already.
The flu's not helping. A lot of oral historians, especially in training, think that
yes.
it only counts if they do them themselves.
Yes.
If they conduct the interview.
I agree completely.
I had a PhD student who's working up in Glasgow contact me and asked if he'd interview my dad, who used to work in the shipyards. And I said to him, I was like, he's been interviewed twice before on different projects. I can tell you where... No. It has to be me doing it because it's from a PhD. And it's like, the idea of reuse hasn't quite filtered down to new projects.
That's right. And you've just made the vital point. The assumption is that original sources, which have to form the basis of a PhD, can only be done if you make it.
Yeah.
In fact, of course, if they go to an archive and use an interview, they're using, you know, what I hate calling it, but, you know, original sources.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but it is the other thing is you're not a proper historian unless you do the interview, unless you go out and do interviews.
Yeah.
You know.
That's so bizarre. I mean, so much of history is about, you know, the archive. so much of history.
Well, I think that and that, that comes back to Paula's point about the fact that oral history hasn't been integrated into the history discipline.
So it's but I think the reason for that, and again, going back to what we were saying earlier on, was that we haven't made those inroads into universities.
Yes, maybe you're right. Maybe you're right.
We don't have that presence. So if we don't have that presence, how do we develop that sort of critique?
Yes, I think you're right.
So we're still standing outside shouting at them.
We are. Absolutely. Absolutely.
You're good at that, though.
That's what you're for, Graham.
Exactly. I'd rather it worked. just coming to a close now and thinking about it. Where next then for Paula? What's next?
What I'm trying to do is to write a book about domestic service that is not, that takes memory, right, and is not using oral history as a source inserted into history. So it's a book about memory, but it's not a book which is intended to be marginally. You know how you get those oral histories, and we produce the books all the time, and people don't read them. Like, you don't get enough of the engagement with it. So what I wanted to do was try and put a different framework around it.
This has been a podcast from the Newcastle Oral History Unit. Thanks for listening, we hope you've enjoyed it, and remember you can contact us via email at oralhistory@newcastle.ac.uk and follow us on Twitter, we're at oralhistory_NCL.